Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Prostate Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This program is a follow-up to a live CME program we did in Chicago at the ASCO meeting in June. I met with Dr. Matthew Smith from the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center in Boston, who is one of the faculty members for this program, to follow up on some of the discussions from the meeting. To begin, Dr. Smith commented on a topic discussed during the meeting, the indirect comparisons of the relative risks and benefits of the major available androgen receptor pathway inhibitors currently approved in prostate cancer.
It's really a blessing in that we have these options, right? So we have four contemporary AR pathway inhibitors, abiraterone, and then the three drugs that specifically target the androgen receptor. And I think most of us view these drugs as interchangeable for efficacy. There isn't much in the way of head-to-head trials, but when you do the cross-trial comparison of very similarly enrolled populations, the efficacy looks the same for the four drugs, as best we can tell. But they do have some differences in their tolerability, including drug-drug interactions and side effect profile. And it is remarkable, how well darolutamide is tolerated. I have to say the other drugs are pretty well tolerated as well, but there do appear to be some meaningful differences. And I think most of the community, not just the academic community, but the general oncology community really appreciates this and is happy to have that option, particularly for patients who are at greater risk for side effects.
But, to see a study in oncology of an oral targeted therapy where it was incredible. I mean, graphic after graphic, there was no difference between placebo.
It's remarkable. And it is consistent with our own experience when we very involved in the original study in non-metastatic CRPC. It's a placebo-controlled trial. And these patients were on drug for long periods of time. Years in many cases, and you really couldn't tell who was on drug and who was on placebo with rare exception, which we learned later when the study was ultimately unmasked after it was successful. That said, the other drugs are pretty well tolerated. The rates of treatment discontinuation, for example, in non-metastatic CRPC are pretty low. We're happy to have these drugs, but for patients where I have particular concerns about safety, tolerability, darolutamide is definitely my go-to drug.
In that regard, in terms of, what you see clinically that kind of sometimes goes beyond sometimes what you can pick up in trials, but, enzalutamide has, there's a lot of thinking in terms of, quote, fatigue, and we can talk a little bit about that and how that really plays out clinically in your practice. But the other one that I'm curious about, and you have the second paper here looking at apalutamide in terms of safety and well-being in older patients, but just globally, I'm kind of curious what sort of sticks out clinically with apalutamide, for example, rash. I mean, is there a clinical thing that you see with apalutamide? You go, oh yeah, this is what we might see?
Yeah, so apalutamide is structurally similar to enzalutamide. The difference being that apalutamide, for a variety of potential reasons, has this risk of rash. Most patients can stay on therapy long-term. They can either have a treatment interruption, treatment with topical steroids, retreated. Most patients we can manage through that, but it is something to be aware of and is a potential headwind for patient compliance with therapy.
So I'm going to move towards, some of the really debate and highly discussed questions in terms of endocrine therapy, particularly androgen-sensitive metastatic disease. But again, I saw a couple of papers I was really curious about. I'm still kind of wondering how AI is going to fit into clinical medicine. I start seeing papers here and there, and I see you were involved. I don't know how involved you were in something that was presented at ASCO last year, AI-enabled analysis of H&E stained prostate cancer tissue images, and then risk for Mets, and I guess this is from trials with apalutamide?
From the Spartan study, yeah. So right. It is intriguing. So, I guess it's an example of how we can do better, right? In this case, we're really talking about tissue analysis using advanced techniques. The neat thing about AI there is, and maybe AI in general, is you don't know what's actually driving those distinctions. And so I think sort of the thing we don't talk a lot about that's potentially very exciting is this could lead to new target discovery, right? The basis for AI's classification of someone, for example, as high risk, as we understand that better, what factors are driving that, it could be very important for identification of new targets, because AI by its very nature is agnostic.
Maybe I don't understand AI that well, but I see it being used in analysis of images, you know, not just here with H&E, but other images. Like, what are you feeding into it that allows the AI program to say something?
So my understanding, so with image analysis, you would load large data sets and with different outcomes. So you have image and outcome, and it's up to the AI to develop a model that would predict those outcomes. And then if valid, you could then use that on a validation set to prove that those observations are correct.
Right.
So, but you don't know what actual parts of the images were responsible for that difference.
Right. Yeah. It's a total empiric thing. That's really interesting. Another thing I was going to ask you about, again, I'm always curious about the endocrinology of prostate cancer. And I was curious by this study looking at darolutamide versus enzalutamide on serum testosterone levels. I wouldn't have thought there'd be a difference, or are you looking at that? You don't have the answer yet.
We are interested in it. It's ongoing. But the notion being that a large part of the side effects of monotherapy, say with enzalutamide, for example, or same as true bicalutamide, is that those drugs cross the blood-brain barrier and through feedback results in approximately doubling of serum testosterone levels, which in men is then converted to estrogen. So you kind of have this feminizing phenotype as a side effect of, say, enzalutamide monotherapy, where you have high T and E levels, but T is being blocked. And so you develop breast symptoms, breast enlargement, nipple tenderness, those sorts of things. So if a drug does not cross the blood-brain barrier, does not cross it well, it may lack that effect of raising serum gonadal steroid levels.
Ah, I get it. So this is really looking at monotherapy with ADT, which of course was looked at in the EMBARK study. Of course, everybody wanted to know, well, what about darolutamide monotherapy? Because as you just said, with ADT, it seems to be better tolerated. What do we know about darolutamide, enzalutamide, and apalutamide without ADT?
Well, I don't know that we know a lot about apalutamide, but there's every reason to believe it would be exactly like enzalutamide, at least in terms of its hormonal effects. The hypothesis behind looking at darolutamide is because it crosses the blood-brain barrier poorly, it may have less of an effect on gonadal steroid levels. And that work is ongoing. We expect that will be reported sometime relatively soon. But that does provide a potential opportunity for an advantage of a drug that doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier or does so poorly.
Really interesting. Also, I want to ask you about this, another paper you did. And also, I know you've done a lot of work with this, and I kind of would like to hear kind of an update, because I don't know what's new. And if I'm interpreting this correctly, it kind of fits into the whole concept of the effect of ADT on metabolism, and particularly long-term cardiovascular risk. And I see you had a paper in a journal I read all the time, Journal of the American Society of Echocardiography. I don't think our audience usually reads that one.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I don't know about this paper, but what's new in terms of figuring out what the impact is, particularly of long-term ADT?
Yeah, so we're really committed to understanding, you know, survivorship in prostate cancer. And, you know, since sort of ADT is a foundational part of that treatment, we've had a long interest in understanding the metabolic and other effects of ADT. So ADT, you know, decreases muscle mass, increases fat mass, decreases insulin sensitivity that leads to the increased risk for diabetes and worsened diabetes control in men receiving ADT. So in the paper you're referring to, one of my colleagues, Phil Saylor, and collaborators in cardiology, looked at the effect of ADT on cardiac output and really found some really interesting effects. And the effects occur relatively quickly too, so which is similar to what we saw with other metabolic effects When we were really interested in the sort of diabetes issue years ago, the prevailing view is the way individuals develop diabetes is through caloric excess. They increase their fat mass, and then as a long-term consequence, develop insulin resistance. But what we found when you give ADT is you can see elevated fasting plasma insulin levels within weeks. So these are very rapid effects. This is not a secondary effect of accumulating fat mass, which takes much longer. And similarly, in this nice paper by Phil Saylor and cardiology colleagues, found that these effects on cardiac output occur relatively quickly.
Just out of curiosity, do you see the same thing in women who are, you know, get LHRH agonists?
I don't know. I don't know that literature well because I'm singularly focused on prostate cancer, but I would expect that some of the effects would be comparable.
You would think? Yeah, you would think so. But for practical purposes, what do you tell your patients?
So this is the responsibility of the treating physician, right? So if you're the physician administering the treatment, you have a responsibility to educate the patients about the effects and provide them guidance about ways to mitigate those side effects. And there are a lot of general principles, right? Like healthy eating, regular exercise, that's got to be part of their routine. And then it goes beyond that, of course, right? Like, so for patients, the patients are at risk for accelerated bone loss and fractures. Those are largely preventable through screening and intervention in appropriate patients. Patients are happy to see their PSA decline, but this is a long-term part of their care. And so it's really an ongoing issue that requires a conversation. And if a physician who prescribes the drugs isn't willing to do it, then their minimum responsibility is to provide that information to patients and collaborate with their primary care doctor or others to help manage these issues.
Can I tell you something that I learned a couple of months ago that I continuously have been bringing up in every possible webinar? There's a program we did with Ruben Mesa on myelofibrosis, believe it or not. And I found in his CV, there was a couple of new drugs that came out that did not help people with myelofibrosis in terms of changing their symptoms. And he did a randomized study using the Mediterranean diet, which is really just low fat. I don't know if you know what it is. To me, it looks simple. It's a lot of, you know, vegetables, et cetera, very little meat, a little bit of, you know, protein, et cetera. But the thing that was interesting is it changed the inflammatory status of these patients. That changed their symptoms. And they think it's like an anti-inflammatory effect. And so I've been wondering, you know, I mean, that is a common, you know, approach that would make sense for people. It's kind of easier to do that, you know, than what you were saying, you know, eat a little bit of whatever. Anyhow, any thoughts about that? It was a randomized study, incidentally.
Yeah, no, I love it. The, diet's complicated, right? for so many reasons. And my family joke is, all my patients have great diets. And do you know how I know that? It's because that's what they tell me, you know, so right. Diet's a very personal thing. So, and I have to say, in thinking about my own approach to nutrition, it's changed over time. Both I've learned things and sort of appreciated the effects of particular diets on my own sense of well-being and health. So diet is very personal, but the typical person has a lot of ways to improve. And the way I approach my patients about this is so much of their care feels like things we do to them. Diet and exercise are things they do for themselves, and that can be very empowering.
Right.
And that's the positive approach that I take to that.
I don't know, for some reason, I guess because you're at MGH, I flashed on, you know, the Jennifer Temel study of palliative care that she did in lung cancer, and then they presented this year in the plenary thing. And I remember, and you know, they showed a difference in survival, but you know, I remember Tom Lynch at that time said, oh, if this were a drug, they would use it. I know there's a big trial going on right now in breast cancer on diet in the adjuvant setting. I mean, all that, if they can show the same kind of improvement that you show with new drugs, it'd be interesting to see how that affects, you know, reimbursement and what people do. So a couple other things I was going to ask about, again, just really it's your work, but also I feel like there's things I've been hearing a lot about, And one is issue as reflected again in a paper last year at ASCO, and I've seen other stuff, I think at ESMO too, looking at PSA response to treatment as a factor in how you evaluate patients. And I think one, you know, way I've heard it talked about is, for example, a patient who's about to start ADT for the first time, you know, hormone sensitive metastatic, the potential strategy of holding off on intensification and seeing, you know, what happens with just ADT. I don't know if that's the type of strategy you're looking at, but can you comment in general and about this issue of looking at rapidity of response and integrating it into treatment plans?
Yeah, I think, you know, not, I guess maybe unsurprisingly, the, you know, better PSA kinetics after treatment results are associated with better outcomes. So the classic kind of responder versus non-responder curve, or in this case, responder versus lesser responder curve. And that's been looked at in a whole bunch of ways. And almost any way you parse the data, like you see this effect, whether it be, you know, undetectable PSA in the case of, you know, de novo metastatic disease, PSA less than 4, you know, as was done in the early ADT, intermittent versus continuous ADT study. So there's sort of a consistency of this effect, and perhaps it's unsurprising. I think its greatest value really is in thinking about how we might intensify therapy for patients with a suboptimal response. I worry a lot about it if it's going to be used to parse out decisions about whether you would intensify or not. I do have to say, depends on what therapy we're talking about, right? And the consistent evidence is to add an AR pathway inhibitor. And there, the burden is relatively low. These are oral therapies, generally well tolerated by most patients. Very different than, for example, chemotherapy decisions, where the impact on quality of life is greater. And when we only had docetaxel as the life-prolonging drug in metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer, I have to say, personally, we would do that sometimes, where a patient was on the fence about whether they would accept chemotherapy. And if you saw that they were having a suboptimal PSA response, you'd try to encourage them to get on with treatment. But in the case of AR pathway inhibitors, I do not take that approach. I really think the worry is if taken too far, what you're going to do is just miss out on the opportunity for this meaningful survival benefit.
No, I mean, it really makes no sense not to use an AR pathway inhibitor. Yeah. I think exactly what you're saying, though, is maybe docetaxel. That's a different story. And that really leads into the other paper I wanted to ask you about and the other issue. And, you know, we always bring this up because this is a continuous question from oncologists. But I see you wrote a review article along with a bunch of other prominent people in JAMA Oncology, Metastatic Hormone-Sensitive Prostate Cancer and Combination Treatment Outcomes, a review. So let's just talk in general about this issue because, you know, really from the perspective of the general medical oncologist, they kind of really don't exactly understand what you all are saying, to be honest with you. And I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but the message that they're getting is, in general, for LHRH agonists, AR intensification for sure, but for younger patients who can tolerate chemo, who have higher volume disease, the message they're getting from you is that they should seriously consider chemotherapy. Your paper, among many others, reviews this, and oncologists come back to me and go, where's the data? Why are they saying for us to give chemo? We do this in breast, all our trials in breast cancer, when we did it, when we saw data roll out like that, we held off on the chemo until they progressed. Why are we giving it?
Yeah, so it's a fair question. And, you know, I think to answer that, I have to kind of give a historical perspective on Arisense.
Absolutely. You
know, thank you. So well, you at know, the time we just...
well, let me just say, too, I was going to ask you also, yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind is really amazing. And I wonder whether, particularly people who are new to oncology, like people who are fellows right now, if they really realize what happened when the pandemic hit. Because when the pandemic hit, we were still in the charted versus, you know, intensification hormones as either option. And, right. You know, that was just the timing. And, of course, everybody moved away from docetaxel. But it kind of never made a whole lot of sense to a lot of people why we're even thinking about docetaxel without intensifying the hormones. Anyhow, that's why
yeah.
it's
yeah,
all so the messed historical- up in our heads.
You're right. And there's a few other key pieces here. So, you know, these drugs were moved up sort of in sequence, right? So docetaxel was approved long ago in mCRPC. So it was logical that it would be moved up first. And these studies take years to complete. And so when we were designing ARASENS, there was just really confirmation from a second trial, Stampede, that docetaxel did in fact improve survival in MCSP, what we now call mCSPC. And so we saw docetaxel improved survival, overall survival, and we felt if we were going to meaningfully change the field, we needed to use a contemporaneous comparison, meaning the winning arm of the previous trial, ADT and docetaxel, and we needed to design a trial to show an improvement in overall survival. So we did the hard thing, which is required everyone receive chemotherapy, and then you know the placebo control part was with Darrow versus placebo. And we did that before the first study reported that AR pathway inhibitors improve survival. Right? So that was the design of the trial. And then, of course, Latitude reported, other studies then reported that AR pathway inhibitors improve survival. And so we were the first triplet study, but it, of course, doesn't answer the question of whether you need docetaxel. But we designed the trial at a time when we didn't know whether intensification with an ARPI would improve survival. So it does look a bit confused now. And if I could go back in time, I would have done a three-arm trial that one of the arms didn't include docetaxel.
You know, I think it's fine, you know, to just say, listen, look, I respect all of you. If you think that patients are better off, younger patients who can handle chemo with higher volume or visceral disease, I totally respect that. But let's just put the cards on the table. That's based on a lot of indirect comparison and not the traditional evidence that we look for. And
that's right. There's not a randomized controlled trial of the doublet ADT ARPI plus or minus chemotherapy. And I speculate that there probably never will be an adequate trial to address that question.
So we'll always be in this situation. So all I'm saying is let's just get the cards on the table, because like you read this paper, and an oncologist, you probably won't be able to read the whole paper because there's so much stuff in there, is going to come away thinking, oh, everybody who can get it needs to get chemo. And I just think that's not right.
I agree with you. And that is certainly not my own clinical approach. And we do have to be really careful. I have to say I was a bit surprised when we presented and published ARASENS that the most common questions that we received are, what were your subgroup analyses? Why didn't you look at high volume versus low volume, high risk versus low risk? And we went on to do those subgroup analyses basically at the request of the community, but I never really understood the request because the study wasn't designed to ask a chemotherapy question. It was designed to ask a darolutamide question. And we know from the vast experience of other ARPIs that the benefits are seen across, you know, a wide range of subgroups, basically all of the subgroups. So when we present that data, I think it could be misinterpreted to mean that triplet therapy improves survival in, say, low risk or low volume disease. We never asked a docetaxel question in this study. All patients received docetaxel. So that those subgroup analyses don't inform those decisions. And we are left really using sort of best available information about where the benefit resides in the doublet studies of ADT docetaxel. And those, they have their own limitations there. I think that the relatively consistent observation is that the benefit is in patients with particularly poor prognosis disease. And I believe that's because, you know, when these patients progress, while we think, well, you could just give them the drug later, in the very poor prognosis disease, when they progress, they may miss the opportunity. And that's where I think moving the chemotherapy up earlier is particularly important. And that's how I think about the patients in my own practice. If you have particularly poor prognosis disease, given the choice, you're going to receive chemotherapy eventually. And I would prefer to do it now if you're fit enough and capable enough to do that. If your cancer-specific mortality looks low, you have recurrent low-volume disease, or you're at risk for dying of other causes, then I'm quite content saving chemotherapy for later or never.
And, you know, really, this model fits a lot of things in oncology. You know, for example, surprisingly, you know, just we see more and more data. You know, you look at targeted treatment of lung cancer, osimertinib, now they're adding chemo in the beginning. In some patients, same rationale, you know, maybe they're going to progress in that earlier stage. Same thing with PD-1. you know, you have high patients with a high PD-1, are you going to add chemo because of the possibility they might progress earlier? So that strategy makes sense. It's just, as like you say, you have to realize the fact that the trial kind of didn't exactly address it, but what you, you know, what you've observed clinically is also really important. Let's go into our next topic that I want to ask you about. Of course, another really important, relatively new topic that, you know, also gets into what is really going on in the community, you know, getting back to hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. Supposedly, there are a whole bunch of people who are only getting ADT alone, which is sort of hard to believe. You know, sometimes I wonder, are there economic factors presented, you know, that are involved here? But it really gets into the issue of, are we getting the messages out there, and are, can docs in practice actually sort of move forward with the messages that we're, you know, kind of getting there to them? Incidentally, do you think, I mean, you see a lot of second opinions. Do you see people managed in a, you know, regular medical oncology setting who get, you know, LHRH monotherapy for hormone sensitive metastatic prostate?
Regrettably, yes, we still see that even in, you know, in Massachusetts, Eastern Massachusetts, mostly coming from community urologists, other places like that.
Urologists. Some community. That's interesting.
I mean, look, there are different models of care. Some patients primarily receive their care with urology. I'm not picking on a specific discipline. It just that those are my observations. I think there's three big drivers, Neil. One is, there is some lack of understanding of the evidence. They just aren't aware of the evidence. Number two is, when folks are aware of the evidence, I think there's some lingering misunderstandings from Charted in those days that intensification is only necessary and helpful for patients with particularly poor prognosis disease. This is, of course, completely untrue in the case of ARPIs. And then third, there's this view that, well, I can just give that to the patient later. But that question has been asked and answered in every trial of the ARPIs. There was a very high rate of crossover to subsequent ARPI in the control group. So while not specifically designed to be early versus at progression, that's in fact what happened to almost all patients in those trials. So there's we know that delaying initiation of the ARPI is the losing arm of those trials. So it really should not be the preferred form of management.
But again, you know, it's not the only time that they're dealing with this kind of situation. I know breast cancer is very different, but if you actually look at it, they never give an LHRH agonist alone to somebody in the adjuvant situation. They're going to add tamoxifen or an AI. I mean, they just don't do that anymore. I don't think they do it. But anyhow, you know, I always wonder about these real-world data. And speaking of that, and our next topic, PARP inhibitors. So, you know, before we start getting in some of your papers, and I see a lot of cool papers on niraparib, but I also want to ask you about some of the stuff, particularly the Brackaway paper from ASCO on olaparib. But again, getting back to this issue, is the message getting through? Do you think that in the community, people are getting appropriate genomic evaluation when they have metastatic prostate cancer, which would, to me, be a minimum of germline testing?
Yep. So often, yes, I would say, particularly from medical oncology, absolutely. And fortunately, you know, prostate cancer is late to the game, right? There's been a role for tumor genetic testing, right, and germline testing in a variety of other malignancies. So in a lot of ways, my community colleagues are ahead of the academic colleagues in terms of understanding of the role of that testing. In prostate cancer, it's comparatively new. So we do see that, and it is critically important. And we'll get into this as I think we talk about the evidence and various approvals for PARP inhibitors, but the benefit really clearly resides in patients who are so-called biomarker positive, but particularly patients with BRCA2 mutations. And that's consistently seen across really all of the trials.
So yeah, and of course we have a long history of, you know, education, particularly in ovarian cancer, but also breast cancer as well. And, you know, there, I think the message is getting through there that if you've got a patient with BRCA, they better be on a PARP inhibitor or whatever else they might be on. So I think this is fitting into that as long as they're getting tested. But of course, then the question is which PARP and in what situations? And of course, now we have increasing data bringing PARP up earlier in combination with androgen-based therapy. You've done a lot of work with niraparib, but of course, there's been a lot of work done with other PARP inhibitors. Can you kind of sort of summarize the bottom line of how you see it today for someone in practice? What are the clinical nodal points that come up in these discussions? And particularly in the patients who are identified to be BRCA2, when do you start thinking about a PARP inhibitor and which one?
Yep, great question. So at the present time, PARP inhibitors only have a role in mCRPC, right? So there are studies that are looking at their use in mCSPC, but it'll be a while before we have that data. And outside of a clinical trial, I would not recommend treatment with a PARP inhibitor in mCSPC. As tempting as that might be, we don't do it yet. So mCRPC, and there's two populations, right? Those who already had their ARPI for mCSPC, in which case they're sort of like, you know, the next standard line of treatment might be chemotherapy. There, for a particular patient with a BRCA mutation, I would enthusiastically treat with a PARP inhibitor, most likely olaparib, because that's, you know, approved in that specific setting. And the study of the rucaparib randomized trial actually provides some sequencing information to say that it's preferable to give a PARP inhibitor prior to chemotherapy. The second population is patients who have not yet had an ARPI, where the combination studies come into play. And again, for patients who are biomarker positive, particularly those with the BRCA mutation, I would first wonder why they haven't already had an ARPI, but if they didn't, I would give the doublet ARPI PARP inhibitor based on the randomized controlled trial showing a benefit in biomarker positive patients, as well as the BRCA-weight trial, which really like established sort of the sequencing question, which is to say that it is better to give them together than to sequence them one after the other.
I'm curious, in a patient who's known to be BRCA positive, whether I assume there's no difference somatic or germline in terms of the therapy, who has hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, who's not able to enter a clinical trial, I assume you're probably sending them out without getting a PARP inhibitor as part of their initial therapy. And I wonder how you feel about. And I wonder how you feel about doing that.
I'm okay with that, mostly because, I mean, this is a situation where we really do need the evidence. Like, so for one, some of those patients would respond to their doublet, let's say ADT ARPI, for years, right? And so if we say we're going to combine it with a PARP inhibitor, you'll be exposing patients to potentially years of a PARP inhibitor, at least many, many months of a PARP inhibitor, without at least level one evidence for better outcomes and in full knowledge that there are side effects of these drugs, which are considerably more substantial than, say, an ARPI, to put it in one way. More like chemotherapy than an ARPI. So until we have the evidence showing that that results in a better outcome, I would not favor, you know, doing it outside the context of a clinical trial. But I do want that information about their genetic status, germline and tumor genetic status, because then I would prioritize initiation of a PARP inhibitor at the earliest indication of progression. And so that's the best reason, I guess, to argue for earlier testing. So we recommend germline genetic testing for all of our patients with metastatic disease. And the typical patient with sort of bad de novo metastatic disease, we're typically doing somatic genetic testing at the first visit when we meet them. And even knowing that that information is not immediately actionable based on labels or evidence, it is useful in both in terms of thinking about the doublet versus triplet question. Patients with particularly, you know, poor tumor genetics might be yet another reason to consider adding chemotherapy early. And then in the event they have a DNA repair mutation, then they would be sort of prioritized for starting a PARP inhibitor at earliest indication of progression.
One thing, you know, I was curious to ask you about, because you've done so much research on niraparib, you know, We track the story of niraparib and olaparib and ovarian cancer. And one of the things that was kind of interesting about niraparib was this weights and platelet thing to guide dosing that they use in women anyhow, where they ended up using a lower dose. And nowadays you look at their platelet count and their weight. What about in men? Do you see thrombocytopenia with niraparib? Any considerations about dosing, or is that much of an issue?
All the PARP inhibitors have hematologic toxicities. Niraparib is probably somewhere in the middle of those drugs, at least in the dose and schedule it's used in combination with abiraterone. And that is a lower dose than it's used in the monotherapy studies of prostate cancer because of drug-drug interactions. Sort of typical, I guess, PARP-like safety profile. Appears to have less hematologic toxicity than talazoparib, at least, again, at the dose that was scheduled with talazoparib.
Yeah, it was interesting. I don't know what it was, but in women, they saw pretty specific thrombocytopenia, though, pretty significant. Let me ask about another paper. You know, for us outside the field, it's so hard to try to figure out what's important or not. You know, so many things are happening. I saw that there was this paper presented at the ASCO GU symposium. I don't think it was presented again at ASCO, but maybe it was the Brackaway study, randomized phase two of abiraterone, olaparib, or abiraterone plus olaparib. Looks kind of, this is people with HRR mutant prostate cancer. It looked pretty interesting.
Yeah, so important? I think it is important as an important piece of evidence, because one of the limitations of the combination studies, you know, ARPI plus minus PARP inhibitor studies, is they were not formal sequencing trials. You got your ARPI plus the PARP inhibitor, and then in the control group, you might get a PARP inhibitor at progression or not. There was no requirement to do that. So one of the criticisms of those trials is like, how could you sort of not require a PARP inhibitor in patients who had DNA repair mutations, given that would be an approved use of the drug? And some of the difference between the arms might be accounted for by the lack of complete crossover in the control group. So the Brackaway study kind of is this additional piece of information that addresses that, right? Because without a formal sequencing phase three trial, one criticism might be, well, I could just sequence the drugs rather than give them together and they might do just as well. But the Brackaway trial sort of formally addresses that by being a sequencing trial. So it's a modest size, you know, randomized phase two, but as you point out, the results are pretty unmistakable. It was, you know, far better to receive the combination than sequential therapy.
So yeah, that's a real practical question. Another thing I want to ask you about, we'll get to lutetium in a second when we talk about ASCO, but I noticed again in your CV several interesting papers on radium-223. I've always been interested in radium. In the beginning, I wasn't sure where it fit in, but I see some new things I hadn't heard about. Circulating and imaging biomarkers of radium-223 response, journal JCO Precision Oncology, and this one is interesting. Radium-223 has immunomodulatory effects and facilitates anti-program PD-1 in murine models. I don't know if that's just a laboratory thing or really maybe explains some of the data, but anything you want to say about radium-223? We haven't talked about it lately.
Yeah, so radium-223 is a bit different, right? So radium is in the same column as the periodic table as calcium. It's taken up in the skeleton like calcium. And, you know, prostate cancer is notable in that most these metastases are osteoblastic. They have a net new bone formation and accumulation of calcium. They're sclerotic bone metastases. So radium is taken up in that space. So designed as a, you know, anatomically targeted therapy for bone metastases. And given that prostate cancer is usually bone only or bone dominant, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, approved based on evidence of improved overall survival years ago, but in the era before we had ARPIs and some other available therapies. So I think it's, you know, a lot of competition now with PSMA-targeted therapy, which doesn't target only bone, but targets non-skeletal sites of disease. And I'd say, you know, pretty clearly has more compelling evidence for benefit. But the radium, the interesting thing about radium is like these survival benefits were observed, even though you don't typically see responses. So like PSA declines are relatively uncommon. Bone is not a measurable site of disease, so you can't record radiographic responses, but you're seeing the survival benefit without classic anti-tumor responses. So this work done by thoughtful colleagues and collaborators was to look at potential mechanisms of activity of the drug and also try to understand response and resistance. So perhaps there's some interesting clues that come out of that work to understand how you can have this sort of discordance between low response rate but a survival advantage.
You know, one thing a lot of oncologists ask us, I think the videos we showed, they asked it also is, you know, can you sequence radium and lutetium? Or are there any situations where you'd use radium before lutetium? And one instance that was brought up, and I'm curious, you know, how you deal with it, is people who don't have PSMA uptake but have bone-only disease.
Well, if they don't have PSMA, yeah, so that would be a very good setting to consider radium.
Seems like it.
True PSMA-negative disease, typically it's a different biology and a poor prognosis. So there are also patients who are more likely to have lytic bone metastases. So you'd have to be positive on a technetium bone scan, negative on a PSMA PET CT, but it'd be an unusual scenario, but that would be a very good setting to consider radium.
Yeah, so as long as we're talking about radiopharmaceuticals in the theme of, I don't know whether it was really important, but it sort of looked important. Any comment about this paper that was, I think Oliver Sartor, I saw his name on there, actinium-225 labeled antibody targeting human kallikrein. It looked kind of cool, but you tell me.
Right. So, you know, this we're at the beginning, early chapters of this RLT story in prostate cancer, maybe in oncology more generally. But there's obviously a lot of enthusiasm following on the approval of PSMA lutetium based on the results of the VISION trial. A lot of speculation as to whether the drug will be moved earlier based on results of other studies. And, you know, there's competitive therapy. So a number of questions emerge, like, in other words, are there non-PSMA targets that would be appropriate to consider? And are there other radionuclides that could be more effective than lutetium as cytotoxic therapy? And so maybe that question is addressed by both in the case of this actinium kallikrein RLT.
I mean, to a naive eye, you know, it looks like they saw objective responses.
Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely responses to the therapy. So how that will all play out is hard to know, other than to say there's going to be a lot of activity with RLTs in prostate cancer. Both moving drugs earlier in the course of the disease, as well as looking at competitive products.
Yeah, no, I was looking at the slides from the meeting on that, and the, you know, the number of products and trials are unbelievable. I guess that's Oliver. I guess that's what prompted him to move, and you know, it sounds like he totally dove into it 100%. And
he really has, and we're glad he's done so because I think he's doing a great job.
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple other new things that were reported on ASCO, one by you. I'm always very curious. You can imagine how much we've been talking about abemaciclib and breast cancer the last 5 years. When I heard that you all were looking at it, first of all, I was kind of trying to figure out whether it would work or not, and whether it made sense biologically, which I never was able to figure out. But anyhow, you started reporting on some data here. It didn't look too encouraging.
Yeah, so a clearly negative phase 3 trial, but requires some background, right? So, you know, the biology of breast and prostate cancer in many ways is remarkably similar. And as you already stated, like CDK4/6 inhibition has a very important role in breast cancer. And then in non-clinical models, you can make a strong argument for an important role of inhibition of this pathway in prostate cancer, as well as in combination with AR-targeted therapy. So all made logical sense. And then we embarked on this, you know, study in mCRPC that was very systematically developed, right? So lead-in phase 1, dose-finding study, randomized phase 2 for signal detection with pre-established rules about whether you would move forward to phase 3. And that all went well. And then the recommendation from an independent data safety monitoring committee was to move forward. And then ultimately, though, the readout from the phase 3 was negative. There is a signal there, but it's not clinically important or statistically significant. And when we look back at what the results of the randomized phase 2 portion of the study are, it just barely met its threshold. So it's very intentional, deliberate design with basically a variety of provisions that would be required to move forward. Those were all met and we did, but ultimately the study was unsuccessful. So I guess if I could learn from that part, at least of the study design part, there isn't too much different, you could do other than to dial up the stringency of the signal you'd require to move forward to phase three, but that would then be at the cost of missing an active drug. So there are trade-offs with that.
But bottom line is, can you envision a scenario where abemaciclib or any other CDK at this point is going to be helpful?
I really don't see that. And I should add that, there was a separate phase three study done in MCSPC that had an event-driven futility analysis that happened to coincide basically with the readout from Cyclone 2, and that was negative, and so that study's been discontinued. So I don't see a path forward for abemaciclib in prostate cancer, and I would extend that to other CDK4/6 inhibitors as well.
On the other hand, we have another paper from ASCO that seemed pretty encouraging. We've been hearing about this for a couple of years, Dr. Petrylak, presenting on a PROTAC, proteolysis targeting chimeric androgen receptor degrader. Sounds a little bit like fulvestrant or something, or one of these new degraders, but I know it works differently. But anyhow, looks like they saw some responses there, huh?
Yeah, so the way I think about this is, AR is the best validated target in prostate cancer. We have four approved drugs, ARPIs, although they have nearly complete cross-resistance and are interchangeable for efficacy. So the question becomes, like, is there more? Can we have drugs that are either more active and or overcome resistance to the available therapies? And so this is one such approach, the PROTACs, which are AR degraders. I like the narrative a lot, right? So that's emerged from the earlier generation drug ARV-110, and now seen with this molecule, is that you see responses in patients who progressed on prior ARPIs, but those responses are sort of overrepresented or primarily seen in patients with activating mutations in AR, which would predict that it remains a driver. In some cases, AR is no longer a driver, and so you wouldn't expect the drug to work in those cases. So if you can select patients based on certain activating mutations, you have a, I'd say, very respectable response rate. And as been previously documented with the prior molecule, some of these responses are very durable.
Do you see this agent or an agent similar to that coming into practice in the next year or two?
Well, maybe not in the next year or two, because this will require a phase three study with their new molecule. But I think eventually, yes. The way I think about it is, look, other fields have been able to do this over and over again with mutations that are relatively uncommon. Here we're talking about mutations that are more than 10% of prostate cancer patients, a very common disease. So we ought to be able to do this, provided the activity is sufficient to warrant approval.
So I want to ask you about another paper. It's one of my favorite new drugs, tarlatamab, a CD3 bispecific, the first one approved in a solid tumor in small cell cancer of the lung. And I'm really enjoying watching the lung cancer people get ready to use tarlatamab and cytokine release. And here, all of a sudden, here it is, phase 1b study in treatment emergent neuroendocrine prostate cancer. We were talking a lot about a transformation of lung cancer from EGFR to neuroendocrine. Here we're talking about prostate cancer neuroendocrine transformation that is not rare, I think, from what I'm hearing. Anyhow, it looks like they saw a few responses there. What do you think?
Yeah, so this is an area of considerable unmet need. Neuroendocrine transformation or development of a neuroendocrine-like phenotype is one of the mechanisms that patients escape standard therapies. Typically has a very aggressive clinical course and short survival. So, and we basically have had little or no progress in this space for a very long time. And so it's encouraging to see this approach being developed. I see one of the challenges is definitional. Like, so there is this spectrum, right, of sort of neuroendocrine differentiation to complete neuroendocrine transformation. Those are not the same thing. So part of it is going to be definitional in terms of like which patients you're studying and how important is that a mechanism of resistance.
Well, I guess one thing, and I think they did look at this, is what DLL3, the target there?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So in this case, you have a path forward, right? You would require demonstration of that target in order to be enrolled in a trial. So that makes a lot of sense.
So let me see if I can just squeeze in a couple other new things from ASCO that really caught my attention. One thing I feel like we hardly ever talk about, we better start talking about a lot more. And I know that oncologists are not tuned into this. I mean, I don't even know what you think about it. Bipolar androgen therapy. And now there's a randomized study presented, a transformer trial. They have these transformer icons. I don't know if you saw that on their slide. Anyhow, they compare bipolar therapy to enzalutamide. Can you talk about that? And first, explain what bipolar therapy is and do you use it? I know the people at Hopkins used it.
Yeah, certainly would not use it outside of a clinical trial. And I just start by saying that this is not ready for use outside the context of a clinical trial. So the idea is like, so what do we do with, you know, androgen deprivation therapy? We dramatically lower T levels to basically as low as they can be. And then the idea with bipolar therapy is if you sort of alternate between high and low T levels, that you sort of reset the cancer and can like achieve responses. And the investigators from Johns Hopkins have certainly demonstrated that there are responses. The worry, longstanding worry, has been, are there a subgroup of patients in whom you accelerate disease progression by administering testosterone? Right. So it's not something I would recommend doing outside the context of a clinical trial under any circumstances. And they're also comparing it, I think, here, not to enzalutamide as initial therapy, but as a right. second ARPI. So relatively low bar for activity, but I applaud them for taking this approach to doing a rigorous randomized controlled trial.
A lot of people don't know that when tamoxifen became available, the big New England Journal paper that got it approved in metastatic breast cancer, which is like in the mid-80s, it actually was compared to high-dose diethyl stilbestrol. Mm. I don't know if you know that. And it did not have greater efficacy. It just had greater tolerability.
Interesting. I did not know that. I'll have to look that one up.
Yeah, that one's from a while ago. Also, they had these impeded androgen called halotestin. I don't know if you ever heard of that. That caused objective responses, a high-dose impeded androgen, and there was high-dose progesterones that were given at that time, too. They all caused responses. So I don't know. This sort of seems like generally in the same realm. Maybe in a couple of years we'll be doing it. I don't know. Last thing I want to ask you about, there are two big papers, and there's always stuff coming out, but it's really interesting to think about ctDNA and prostate cancer because you guys already have PSA. So anyhow, there are a couple papers, you know, one looking at patients from the PSMA-4 trial, which is super cool, that was presented, and another one, I guess, looking at developing a prognostic model in metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. Any comment on these two papers and in general where you see circulating DNA going both in research and practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think you highlight a key distinction of prostate cancer is that we have this ubiquitously expressed convenient biomarker called PSA. So while this work is very interesting, I don't see ctDNA replacing or even complementing PSA. So I think it's more interesting academic work, and it's not something that we're going to be doing in routine clinical practice.
Interesting. We'll see how that goes. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Smith, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.